It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you've probably heard of HIPAA laws for the U.S. healthcare system, but there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about what they do. We're going to separate fact from fiction and answer your questions coming up. First, the inmate population in Wisconsin's jails and prisons reached a 20-year low in December of last year. That's according to data from the Department of Corrections. That came after years of concerns about overcrowding and with a sense of urgency related to the rise of COVID-19. A new report digs into COVID and incarceration and what it means for the future. That report comes from a group including the Wausau Pilot and Review and Madison 365. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how prisons and jails in Wisconsin adapted during the pandemic or tried to? Are you someone who works or has worked as part of the system? What's your experience been like? Have you or someone in your family been impacted by being in jail or prison, especially during COVID? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shireen Seward is founder and publisher of the Wausau Pilot and Review and host of the Wisconsin Public Radio show Route 51. Shireen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert Chappell is executive director of Madison 365. Rob, welcome to you.
Thanks, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, let's start with you, Rob, and this 20-year low when it comes to our prison, our incarcerated population in the state. Can you talk about the number, how low it was compared to recent standards?
I can tell you about Dane County specifically. That was kind of my focus, and I can also tell you about the state prison or the state jail population as relates to Department of Corrections holds, because those are the ones that have the more flexibility. So those are the ones that were able to be reduced quickly over the course of the pandemic. In Dane County, the population went from about 700 down to just a little bit over 500. Many of those 500 that were remaining in the jails were not subject to sort of sheriff jurisdiction. You know what I mean? They're on parole holds. They're on federal holds, et cetera. But at the state level, those county jail populations that were on state parole and probation holds dropped by about 53%. It went from 3,680 on March 2nd, 2020, down to 1,723 by April 20th. So that, you know, just a little over a month, they were able to get that many people out of county jail custody.
And Shireen, you focused on Marathon County. What did you see there? What kind of changes during COVID?
Very similar numbers-wise. I can tell you that before COVID, we were talking about the need for a $75-plus million jail because overcrowding was so bad. We have a jail here that really is designed for about 250 inmates and was constantly at 400 or above. And the county was paying other counties to house those prisoners. So we had a real problem on our hands. And there were already talks underway about how are we going to manage that? Do we need a new jail? Are there things that we can do that could potentially lower those numbers? And sure, I mean, by 6 months into the pandemic, we were down to about 250. So, you know, back to capacity. So very, very significant drop. And I can tell you that combined Wisconsin's state prisons and local jails, if you look the whole statewide, there were fewer than 30,000 inmates in December. And that was the lowest number in more than 20 years.
Shireen, can you talk about the strategies you saw in Marathon County and elsewhere to limit overcrowding? What kind of decisions were made to say we're going to have fewer people incarcerated?
There are a couple of things that happened. And of course, jail corrections officers can only take control of so much, right? Mm-hmm. So the jail itself did some creative thinking, and they got rid of our Huber program. So everybody that would have been serving jail time and then let out on Huber automatically went to electronic monitoring if they were eligible for that. So we didn't have, the whole Huber wing was emptied. But then also we had a number of inmates that successfully petitioned for lower bond amounts, and judges let them out on a signature bond or a much reduced bond. So there was that level as well. But it all kind of started with the police department saying, we have to be judicious about how many people we're actually bringing into the jail. Because obviously, you know, corrections officials knew that incarcerated people exposed to the virus were getting sick and dying at a much higher rates than the general public. So the police department would use summons for the first time. And before the pandemic, the Wausau Police Department had never used the summons. They just would arrest and bring them in. Now it's a lot different. So they're bringing fewer people in the beginning.
And Rob, did you see similar strategies in place in Dane County?
Yeah. First of all, if I could mention just like the reasoning behind the urgent need to change the way they were doing things is not just for the protection of the inmates, which is obviously important, but also the jails do not exist in a vacuum, right? They're secure facilities, but there are still people going in and out. Mm-hmm. There's staff going in and out. There's inmates coming in for a day or two and going back out. So they're and you're in a tight congregate facility where the virus can spread really quickly and then work its way back out into the community. So there's that. That was the thinking. But also one thing that I was struck by not having reported on criminal justice, but not really being part of the system. How many different agencies and systems need to cooperate to make something like this happen? As Shereen mentioned, it's partly incumbent on the police to exercise some discretion in arresting and making arrests, but also there's something from the judiciary. The judges have to be able to, issue a warrant that doesn't necessarily require an arrest. And then you have to have the sheriff's office, and then you have to Department of Corrections working on the parole and probation holds, and you have to have federal courts willing to release people, which they are not really as willing to do. So there's a lot of different agencies and systems who are used to working together, but not necessarily to solve a common problem like this. And so it was a lot of different strategies. There's, obviously when you go through the criminal justice system, you have many different stops along the way. And every one of those stops is an opportunity to find an alternative to incarceration, which and the other thing that struck me too, is that I heard repeatedly that a lot of these strategies were things that had been worked on for years. Like, this is a thing we've been trying to do. We've been trying to reduce the jail population. We've been trying to find alternative to incarceration for years. And this just really accelerated it, made it really urgent to do right now, which is part of why we wanted to look at this, is to think about, if we've been trying to do this for a long time, we've now proven that we can, will some of these changes become permanent?
We're talking to Robert Chappell, executive editor of Madison 365, and Shereen Seward, founder and publisher of the Wausau Pilot and Review, about a piece they worked on looking at incarceration in Wisconsin, how it changed during the pandemic, getting lower numbers into jails and prisons, and whether those changes might stick around for the future. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, or your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Cliff is with us in Racine. Cliff, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Cliff?
Well, I happen to be in prison up in Oshkosh during COVID, from the beginning of it until about 4 weeks ago. And all I can say is, prison is not a good place to be in any circumstances. And then when COVID hit, it got even worse. I joke with my daughters when I would call them and say, at this point, it's like being in prison. Mm. Because once they finally got to the point of taking it seriously, which actually took them a little while, everything was closed down. We couldn't go out to the yards anymore. We couldn't even go out to the day room anymore. We were locked in ourselves, with being pretty much in solitary confinement with your cellmate. For the last year and a half I was there, I ate every meal sitting on my bunk, which is an interesting experience.
Yeah.
But when they started to take it seriously, they did put a good set of rules in place that would have been effective had they been followed. But they weren't. And when I say they weren't, it wasn't by the inmates. It was by the COs. For example, when they first came out the rules, if we had to go to the bathroom, we had to stand outside our door, leaning on the door, until a CO came and told us it was okay for us to go to the bathroom. Well, we would stand there for a half hour and 45 minutes, and the COs wouldn't come around. So you have no choice but to go. And at the same time, there is a rule that you could only have six inmates in the bathroom at a time during COVID. Well, the only time I saw six or less people was at 3 o'clock in the morning in the restroom. So they had rules in place, but they weren't followed. And in prison, if the COs don't enforce the rules, the inmates are just going to break them by the nature of who they are.
Cliff, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Robert, I think I heard you nodding along there. Did you have thoughts on what Cliff brought up?
Yeah, I think it's, again, I'll defer to Cliff on what the actual experience was like, but I did, having reported on some other stories related to the system, it's just really, when you're in a congregate facility like that, where everything is just closed quarters by nature, by design, it's just almost impossible to actually, no matter what the rules are, whatever you try to put in place, it's just almost impossible to mitigate the spread of a very contagious virus, which is how one out of two inmates was actually infected because of what Cliff talks about. It's just impossible to enforce all those mitigation strategies in that kind of facility, I think.
Cliff, thanks again for being willing to share that story. We're talking to Robert Chappell of Madison 365 and Shereen Seward of the Wausau Pilot and Review, looking at the impact of the pandemic on criminal justice here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests about what they found in their reporting? Do you have an experience to share as an inmate, a family member, an inmate, a staff member, a correctional officer? How did COVID affect your institution, or if you're anywhere on the criminal justice system pipeline, what changes did you see? Do you think they're going to stick around? We're going to be getting into that in just a few moments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Shereen Seward of the Wausau Pilot and Review and Robert Chappell of Madison 365. We're talking about changes in Wisconsin's criminal justice system during the pandemic, in part aimed at lowering inmate populations in jails and prisons, whether some of those changes might stay in place. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts. Do you want to see our overall incarcerated population in jails and prisons go down in the state? What kind of things do you want to see happen? Do you have a personal experience to share from anywhere, being involved anywhere in that system? Call 800-642-1234. Shereen, as Rob mentioned a few moments ago, part of the point of your reporting here was to say, are these changes, these COVID-linked changes, going to change things for the future? What kind of things are you hearing from the people you talk to?
Well, what we're hearing is that some of these things will stay. Some of these things are most certainly going to stay. Getting rid of the Huber program in Marathon County and letting inmates serve their sentences at home so they can care for their children and be with their family and keep their employment while freeing up jail beds, that's something that is going to stay. And I know Rob wants to talk about some of the really positive stuff like video visits and remote court appearances, but I do want to say that what we are hearing from prosecutors is that we are very concerned about what's going to happen in the future, because so many cases didn't go through the system during the pandemic. Basically, trials were put on hold. So you've got people who are waiting for trials for 2-3+ years. And when those cases finally make it through the system, the concern is that we're going to need 1,000-bed jail. And that's what we're really concerned about. But Rob, in part of your reporting, you talked about some of the really positive things that, like the video visits, for example.
Yeah, if I could piggyback on what you just said about the backlog, Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Azan said that Dane County is going to face a similar thing, but that there are a lot of people who are awaiting trial out of jail rather than in jail, and are therefore making a case for themselves that they maybe don't need to be in jail. So when they do go to trial, they might be more likely to be able to convince a judge to give them a either a suspended sentence or a community service type sentence rather than a jail sentence. But the other thing that has changed and maybe both in the prisons and in the jails is the use of video and remote technology, which is something we're all doing for everything. You know, we've all learned how to do Zoom, and I think we'll all be doing lots of more Zoom meetings and Google Meets and everything like that going forward. And the same is true in the criminal justice system. Kevin Carr, the state secretary of corrections, talked about just the savings to taxpayers of, you know, getting more used to doing court appearances by Zoom, where you drive somebody from Stanley to Milwaukee for a 5-minute status conference. Like, just do that online. You know, it's just so much easier and less expensive. However, Dane County ran into some problems with that, with the Dane County jail being old and not really equipped for that. So that people ended up doing their court appearances by Zoom through the food slot in their cell door, which a lot of advocates thought was really dehumanizing, you know, so they got in a little trouble with that. But overall, the idea of doing things more remotely, and it does make sense. And the other thing is visits. You can have more family visits, better family visits by videos. In some cases, Kevin Carr talked about the fact that if you're doing a video visit with your family at home, you can actually get a glimpse of home. Right. You can see the Christmas tree. You can see your dog. You can see your nephew. And that can give folks a bit more maybe incentive to do what they got to do to get back.
And Shireen, did you see that sort of thing happening in Marathon County? More openness to those video hearings and or those video visits?
Yes. And jail staff here, they were quick to point out that this was very beneficial for many of the reasons that Rob stated, especially for juvenile cases. I mean, there's a real, if you don't have to shackle a juvenile and bring him into the courtroom, it takes a big element of the fear factor out of that. So they do think that these video visits will continue, and also it made it easier for representation. As we know, there is a huge shortage of public defenders, and in many cases here in Marathon County, we've had to find public defenders or defense attorneys from well out of the area to represent clients here. So they're able to appear via video. They don't have to make the drive. It helps with their caseload. It helps with the overall cost. So there are some significant benefits to that.
Now, Rob, I know members of the public might hear fewer people in jails, fewer people in prisons, and wonder, is this a public safety problem? Are there some people who should be incarcerated who aren't under these emergency measures or down the road? What kind of things did you hear about people addressing those concerns?
Yeah, that's a great question. And basically what I heard is that they're at the state level, especially when they're talking about parole holds and probation holds, they're actually taking a more proactive approach, looking at the public safety risk of a particular individual. You know, pre-pandemic, pre-March 2020, it was basically if you violated your probation or your parole, you just went to jail. Like that, there was just no thought about it. There was no discretion. They didn't take the time to think about it or look at it. Whereas now, the reason that they went down by 53% and not 100% is that they started to take into consideration public safety. And if somebody was in on like domestic violence charges, they'd be more likely to stay to decide that that person should stay in. Or if it's somebody whose probation violation was, you know, missing an appointment, but their crimes were not necessarily violent and they did not pose a public safety risk, then that person could come out. And there hasn't been, as far as I'm aware, maybe Shireen can, hers are different, but there hasn't been a significant public safety issue in terms of these particular folks who've been allowed to, you know, live their lives in the community as they go through the system rather than in custody.
Yeah, Shireen, what have you heard on the public safety side of things?
In some ways, especially when we're talking about putting people on an electric monitor rather than having them in the Huber wing, jail officials say in some ways we're safer because we know where they are. In the past, they'd sign out for Huber and be gone for 12 hours. And sometimes, you know, you just never really knew where they were. But I think it's really too soon to tell what the overall impact will be on public safety. But I do know that police are really looking to evidence-based decision-making when they determine whether or not to bring someone to jail, period. And jail should be a last resort. It shouldn't be a automatic thing that happens when an officer responds to a situation. Some people absolutely deserve to be in jail and need to be in jail. Other people may not and may do better without. So police are learning how to differentiate and how to make those decisions in a more meaningful way.
And Shereen, you had mentioned at the outset that there was a thought that Marathon County was going to need a new $75 million jail. With these changes, and maybe they're going to stick, is that conversation changing? Are people thinking maybe we don't need that facility?
Oh, right now people are thinking that we maybe don't need that facility. But as I mentioned earlier, there is a significant backlog in cases. Mm-hmm. So it really remains to be seen whether or not we will see a huge explosion of new jail sentences and whether what that's going to mean to the overall community. And, you know, there's also a push for more justice decisions that are restorative justice, mm-hmm. some alternative justice programs. And, you know, those too could keep more people out of jails and free up bed space and free up money for taxpayers.
Rob, just 30 seconds or so left. Rob, go ahead and leave us with some thoughts.
I was going to say that this is all happening in the backdrop of a similar debate here in Madison that's been going on in Dane County. It's been going on for, I don't know, 10 years about building a new jail. And the new jail here in Madison is not necessarily just about overcrowding. It's also about safety and, mental health capacity, capacity to take care of people's health. There's been a lot of opposition to that jail. And I think this just fuels that maybe we don't need to build a new jail. Maybe we need to rethink how we handle people with mental health crises and other alternatives like Shereen was talking about.
We'll leave it there. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Shereen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Shereen Seward, founder and publisher of the Wausau Pilot and Review, host of the WPR show Route 51, and Robert Chappell, executive editor of Madison 365. You can read their report on Wisconsin's prisons and jails at WPR.org. Next, what does HIPAA mean? What does it cover? What doesn't cover? We'll talk about some frequently misunderstood things about HIPAA. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, a judge says that a Wisconsin police officer can face charges in a fatal shooting after prosecutors originally decided not to pursue that case. Get the latest tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if somebody asks about your COVID vaccination status, are they violating the healthcare law known as HIPAA? No, they are not legally. Under COVID-19, HIPAA has become a hot topic of debate as talk about vaccines in the workplace, schools, and elsewhere ramp up. HIPAA stands for Health Insurance Protection and Accountability Act. That's a federal law that was passed during the Clinton administration. To quote the Department of Health and Human Services, HIPAA gives you rights over your health information and sets rules and limits on who can look at and receive your health information. It likely doesn't apply to personal conversations or things at the workplace, for example. We're going to talk about what it does cover and how it works and hopefully clear up some misconceptions and misinformation along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about HIPAA? What questions do you have about it? If you work in the healthcare industry, are there aspects of HIPAA that you find confusing or unclear? What do you really want people to understand about HIPAA yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Rovner is Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of KHN's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us the basics of what HIPAA really is and why it exists?
Yes, HIPAA is actually 25 years old this month. It was signed in August of 1996. I actually covered it. And you got a word wrong. HIPAA stands for Health Insurance Portability and Accountability
yes.
Act. That's right. And that's what it was really for. It was all about being able to take your... We think of portability as taking your health insurance with you when you change jobs. But what HIPAA really did is it made it possible for you to leave one job with insurance and get another job with insurance and not have a year-long waiting period. So it started out really just being about the portability part. It was a bipartisan bill, but Republicans decided that they wanted to have a little more than just that. That was mostly a Democratic idea. So they put in a big chunk of administrative simplification, trying to streamline the way medical records were digitized. We were just starting out with electronic medical records in the 1990s. Obviously, the internet was still pretty young. And at the very end, this went on for like a year, at the very end, Congress said, you know, if we're going to have all of this electronic medical information racing around, we should make sure that it's protected, that people's health information isn't accidentally released. And that's where we got the privacy part of HIPAA. It actually wasn't in the law. What the law said is that Congress should pass another law to ensure the privacy of this medical information by 1999. And if not, then the administration will do it. And of course, Congress missed the deadline. The Clinton administration put out the privacy rules. The incoming George W. Bush administration tinkered with them a little bit. And that's the HIPAA that we have today. It actually took effect in 2003. And that's why every time you go to the doctor, you get that little notice to sign, because that's one of the requirements of the rules. But the important thing about HIPAA is that it only applies to healthcare providers and the people they do business with. So insurance companies, doctors, hospitals, what are called healthcare clearinghouses that handle private medical information. Nobody else is really covered by HIPAA.
And as you mentioned, the P is portability, not the bit of misinformation I gave there. The key is that, or part of the story here is so that, you know, if I go to a clinic here and then switch providers, or a clinic and then an unaffiliated hospital or whatever, these are rules in part, right, to make sure that my information can be shared with my consent to make sure I'm getting the right treatment from one place to another. Is that part of the goal here?
Yes, that's not the portability part, but yes, that is the part of the other half, the accountability part. There was a big anti-fraud piece and then a big administrative simplification piece. So yes, it's about who can have your health information and who needs to protect it from unauthorized disclosure.
What kind of things have you seen out there that are getting HIPAA wrong, that a lot of people are talking about and misinterpreting what HIPAA does?
Well, we've seen athletes, you know, when someone's asked, are you vaccinated? The athlete will say, you know, you can't ask that because of HIPAA. Well, I'm a reporter. Reporters aren't covered by HIPAA. We can ask anything we want. Patients have a right to not tell, you know, to not answer. There's nothing that requires you to answer that question, but there's nothing in HIPAA that prevents anybody from asking it, including employers. Employers have to be careful because there are other laws that employers could accidentally violate, like the Americans with Disabilities Act. But employers are certainly allowed to ask employees about their vaccine status if it has a business reason. And obviously today, you know, with a contagious disease running around, that would be a business reason.
However, if that reporter or that employer called up, say, my healthcare provider and was asking questions about my health conditions or treatments or things like that, then HIPAA kicks in?
Yes, your doctor or your healthcare provider is covered by HIPAA. They cannot release your medical information without your permission.
We're talking to Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, about HIPAA, what it does, what it doesn't do, misinformation out there. You can join in with your questions or comments at 800-642-1234. Are you confused about claims you've heard about what HIPAA is and isn't? If you work in the healthcare industry, at a clinic, insurance company, you name it, are there places where HIPAA makes life difficult or confusing for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Julie, we should distinguish HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A, which is the thing we're talking about, from a thing that's going around a lot on social media, HIPAA, H-I-P-P-A, which doesn't exist. Have you been
that's
seeing
right.
this floating around?
That's right. I have indeed. And I mean, this has been a problem from the beginning. People hear HIPAA and they just assume it's spelled H-I-P-P-A. It is not. It is spelled H-I-P-A-A because it is simply the acronym for the name of the law.
What? How limited are the privacy protections in actually existing HIPAA?
They are, I mean, basically what HIPAA is trying to do is say that people who have what's called protected healthcare information, your personal medical information, can't release it except to people who, other people who are authorized to have it, to anybody that you give permission. HIPAA also has a piece, where you can actually get access to your own medical records, which was not a legal right prior to HIPAA. Before that, you had to ask, and sometimes there would be, you know, enormous charges for, you know, Xeroxing medical records. But that it is limited to people who have who collect your medical information and who have reason to share it with others.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Caledonia. Jack, hi.
Yeah, a couple things you mentioned. One was the American Disability Act, okay, which prevents anybody from discriminating against anybody with a medical condition, correct?
That's correct. Well, a disabling medical condition. A medical condition that's considered a disability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is death considered a disability? I mean, if they're saying COVID, you know, creates death, is that a potential, you know, disability or, you know.
Well, I guess, what are you asking, Jack?
You know, because, you know, the point is asking somebody about their medical situation, okay, they can ask a question, but there's nothing that compels you to answer it, okay? And if they prevent you from going into the store just because you don't answer it, you know, isn't that discrimination?
Oh, I see where you're going, Jack. Okay, thanks a lot. So Julie, if a store or workplace says, show you're vaccinated or you can't come in, or show you're vaccinated, you can only come in with a mask, and Jack is raising concerns that that's a form of discrimination based on health status, I think is where he's going with that, Julie.
Yeah, but it's not based on disability. Mm-hmm. So it's not covered by the ADA.
Got it. Jack, thanks a lot for calling in with a question. Let's go to Andrew now in Janesville. Andrew, hi.
Yeah, hi. I had a question back when I was a journalist. Sometimes we would ask county governments, school districts, and this was relevant during COVID early on, whether or not they have reported cases and where those cases were, like, you know, down to the municipality or a particular school, and their response was that would violate HIPAA because, you know, even though we're not requesting the name or the identity of anyone, they said by saying that there would be a case there, that somehow could, you know, out the person or identify the person. And, I just remember going in circles with them and, you know, their legal people about that. I always thought it was ridiculous. Just kind of seemed like a cop-out.
Andrew, thanks a lot for that story. Julie, I don't think that HIPAA would cover a city releasing statistics about COVID by, I don't know, zip code or municipal block or things like that.
No, it doesn't. And HIPAA doesn't cover most schools and school districts. It would not be a HIPAA violation. Could be a privacy violation. And there are some states that do have stricter laws than HIPAA. But generally, we've seen over the years, and as a reporter, I've seen this many times, people refusing to answer questions citing HIPAA when HIPAA has nothing to do with the reason they don't want to answer the questions. I've seen veterinarians who have cited HIPAA in talking about animal health. HIPAA does not cover animals. It only covers people. And it doesn't cover, this is really important, de-identified information. So information that is not connected to an individual person. That was important because researchers were worried that they wouldn't be able to get a hold of important information that they need. They don't need the person's name, but they would need things for public health, like how many COVID cases there are.
Thanks a lot for that call, Andrew. We're talking about HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, with Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host of KHN's What the Health podcast. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how HIPAA works and your HIPAA rights, what it does and doesn't do? Have you found a claim about it, maybe on the social media, that you have found puzzling? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now on health privacy laws, especially the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, also known as HIPAA. Just part of it's about privacy, really. There's been a lot of confusion and misinfo out there about what it is, what it covers, what it doesn't. Kaiser Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner is here to help us sort it out. And you can join in with your questions and comments, maybe experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Robert is with us in Sister Bay. Robert, hi.
Hello. My question is, if a healthcare provider has a contract with a third-party data management business to manage their patient health information, so they're not managing it directly, they've hired another company to do that, is that third-party data management business subject to HIPAA patient info release rules?
Interesting question, Julie.
Yes, absolutely. That was one of the original requirements. It's called business associates, that basically everybody who handles medical information as part of sort of the health insurance process, which includes billing and maintaining records, they are all covered by HIPAA.
Robert, thanks a lot for the question. Let's go to Zeke now in Horicon. Zeke, hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for putting me on the air. The young lady before I talked to a screener, I thanked her for Rob for at least admitting that you did pass on some misinformation about HIPAA.
Got the P wrong.
And,
yes.
Well, good. That's good. Good. You could do that, because typically I hear you put on a lot of guys like Jack and the Milwaukee Republicans that just can't stand any kind of government in any way, shape, or form.
Right, what do you want to ask about, Zeke?
I want to thank the lady for putting on the information. Not asking, it's just simply this. HIPAA was done, nothing to do with vaccines. It had everything to do with insurance companies, which were trying to get information from people illegally to get them off their policy or exclude coverage for them. That's all HIPAA is about. And it was the evil of the Clintons who did that, government interfering try to protect people from getting screwed by insurance companies. So that's just what I wanted you to know, Rob.
Zeke, okay. Thanks for the call. Julie, was that part of the story of why we have HIPAA, keeping insurance companies from finding information that they could use to bump us, as Zeke says?
Well, no, they still could. It was just telling them even if they found that information, they couldn't bump you, at least in certain cases. The Affordable Care Act was what really made the restrictions on pre-existing conditions go away. But HIPAA was the first piece of that. What was going on at the time is that there was sale of medical information used for advertising, you know, when you would get the postcards from the drugstore that said, you know, we know you have diabetes, you may be interested in this product. That was one of the things that HIPAA, that the privacy part of HIPAA was intended to address, was the marketing.
Talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News, looking at HIPAA, what it is, what it isn't, what it means for your medical records. Still time for you to join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alyssa is with us now in La Crescent, Minnesota. Alyssa, hi.
Hi. I had a kid that ended up with COVID back in when school was still going on. And so the school nurse ended up contacting us, but the school nurse ended up actually also being a hockey liaison for COVID. And then she ended up contacting us through the Hockey Association before we had released that information about our child. I was just wondering if that was within her right or if that should have been us to tell them, which we would have told them, but just wondering.
Interesting. So a school nurse going to the sports team and giving a heads up on COVID, Julie.
That's a really interesting question. That very well could be a HIPAA violation, because a school nurse would have been covered by HIPAA and and probably should not have told anyone else. There are public health exceptions, though, to HIPAA, and that's sort of the irony of all of this. So that may have been part of the public health, or it could have been part of contact tracing. So it's not as quite as cut and dry as sometimes it seems.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Julie, one thing that, as I understand it, is very much not covered under HIPAA is information we put it out there in the world ourselves. For example, semi-hypochondriacs like me searching every health condition on the internet, that information is fair game for the Googles and others of the world to aggregate and do with what they want, right?
Yes, it is. That's not Google is not a healthcare provider, and neither are you.
There are gray areas where I understand some big technology companies may have health-related affiliates. So if, I'm going to make this up here, Google buys a health data company, maybe a third-party processor, does HIPAA mean they have to have kind of a wall between information they collect in one place and information they collect in another?
That's what very high-powered lawyers are there to figure out. You know, even Amazon, which is now getting into the pharmacy business, that part of the business would a HIPAA would apply to them, and I think they would have to be kept separate. I apologize, my dog barking in the background.
And that's not a HIPAA violation, barking during a conversation about HIPAA. Do I have that right, Julie?
Correct. Pretty sure not.
It's okay. It's during COVID, we've got to meet a lot of people's pets, so not a problem at all.
I figured.
It's actually been kind of fun. I've kind of liked it. So, Julie, HIPAA has been revised a few times and updated over the years. Is there any talk about, hey, technology has changed, the industry has changed? Is there talk about updating HIPAA now for the future?
You know, I haven't heard a lot of talk about that. There's a lot going on in Washington on healthcare. I think HIPAA probably could use an update. Remember, it's not technically a law. It's technically a regulation. So it could be updated anytime an administration wanted to. And it has been updated, you know, over the years via regulation, because that's technically what it is.
And Julie, this misinterpretations, misinformation about HIPAA, what it is, what it does, it's just part of a big landscape of misinformation in the health world out there. What would you recommend to people as they see claims about health, about vaccines, about HIPAA, you name it? How do they make sure they're getting good information?
Well, HIPAA in particular, there's a very good website maintained by the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal HHS, which is responsible for actually enforcing the law and cracking down on people who violate the law. Consumers can file complaints if they think that they've had their personal information wrongly disclosed. That's a really good place to go to get information. There are a lot of good government websites. I mean, there is so much information. I should point out misinformation about HIPAA is as old as HIPAA itself. It's just we've seen a lot of it during COVID because so many people are concerned about whether other people might have a contagious disease. So it has come up more. And as you point out, we've seen more purposeful disinformation. There's been a lot of misunderstanding of HIPAA, but it hasn't mostly been for malfeasance purposes. Whereas I think with a lot of COVID, there have been people who have been purposely spreading information that's incorrect.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me and the dog.
That was Julie Rovner and her dog. Julie is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of KHN's What the Health podcast. She gave us an explanation of HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and what it does and doesn't cover. If you're looking for any particular information related to COVID and health and haven't heard us talking about it or not much anyway, let us know about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you want to know. If you're seeing a lot of information out there, say on your social media, for example, that you think is confusing or you think it might be misleading, give us a heads up and something we can tackle in a future conversation, much like this one, maybe with Julie again. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, cars and a lot of other products are being held up in the manufacturing process by a shortage of specialized computer chips. We'll find out what's going on and what it means for you if you are looking to buy one of this growing list of products. And what responsibilities do we humans have toward wild animals? What does it mean to be wild? And when do our efforts to help them actually make things worse? We'll tackle those questions with the author of the new book, Wild Souls, that and more tomorrow on Central Time. Hey, here's another installment in the long-running saga of record-breaking vintage video game sales. I told you a couple months back about a copy of a Super Mario game that went for $660,000 in an auction. That was a record then, and now it's in the rearview mirror. Since then, a copy of Legend of Zelda sold for $870,000. Last month, an unopened Super Mario Brothers sold for $1.5 million. Well, that record didn't last long either. Now, as reported in the New York Times, a copy of 1985 Super Mario Brothers has sold for $2 million. This wasn't an auction. The game was bought last year by an investing site for just $140,000. Now they've turned it around for a big, big profit. Why would somebody pay $2 million for an old video game? I don't have an answer for you, but it's making me regret my decision to donate my old N64 a few years back. I mean, I gave it to, you know, a Salvation Army type place where they either recycle it or sell it if they can. It wasn't in great condition. The controllers, they kind of wiggled a bit. It didn't make a difference in most games. But in Madden football, if you tried to play a defensive lineman, like they would just like drift off sides on every play. You had to play a linebacker or D-back. So probably not a lot of money there. I probably didn't miss out much. Video game news you can use. This is Central Time.